It's Tuesday, April 12th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 228 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 5 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
Oh my God, this beer is delicious.
What beer? It's all gone.
It is all gone. I will, except for Dan's, which I've been eyeing, and it's like I want to steal it.
Fine,
so,
no, I'll let you
so the Danger Brewery guys, Killer Cheese Wedge and Kazelle at Fear the Con, gave me a single bottle of Panepot, P-A-N-N-E-P-O-T beer. It's imported from Belgium.
Just assume it's pronounced wrong.
Yeah, I do. Panepot, Panepot, Poot, whatever. But anyway, thank you guys. This was a very, very delicious beer, and I decided to bring it instead of chug-a-lugging it right after the con. I saved it till we were recording, and then I forgot the last time we recorded.
He's nicer with the beer than the cigars that Cigar Smoker sends him, so.
What? So, but it was very good. Thanks, guys.
Real quick announcement. This is a something that you guys might be interested in. I'm hoping you're interested in.
I'm not interested.
You already told me you were. Just did not.
Don't even know what you're talking about.
I was told about this after our interview with Shane Ivey, so it didn't make it into the episode itself, but I wanted to be sure to hit it now, which is Shane Ivey has offered to our listeners 15% off of any Art Dream products, provided you buy them through their online store. All you have to do is enter a coupon code, which is just Fear the Boot, all one word, and you'll get 15% off anything they're selling in there. The only restriction on it is this expires on May 1st. So if you're interested in picking up a copy of Monsters and Other Childish Things,
I am.
Wild Talents or whatever, then be sure to get out there and get that coupon code used before the month of April ends. And I know you told me you were interested because you said you were probably going to pick up your own copy of Monsters.
Yeah.
Even though you have mine right now, which is fine.
Does a group really need more than one copy?
Yeah.
You need two copies.
I do need two copies.
Chad does need two copies.
Yeah, you need two copies, and the rest of us actually read rules. So, yes.
Indeed, indeed. Hey, I tell you what, I've been reading this book. None of the rules, mind you, just the fluff and the interesting parts.
You're just reading it for the articles?
Pretty much.
He's just looking at the pictures.
Yo, the pictures are great. I do have to describe what the picture that just blew me away was the opening one. It's about monsters and other childish things. You play a child. Or a monster possessing a child, and it's really creepy. But anyway, it's sort of told from the child's perspective. You know how kids will draw stuff with magic marker, and it bleeds through? Well, they printed the pictures on the front, like the covers are all drawn in and written on, and tells like this story. And the front insert, like the first leaf of paper, is drawn on in magic marker. At least it's printed to look like that. When you flip it over, they printed the other side of it as if it bled through with magic marker, like in school. I thought that was really clever.
So Chad and I at work today were kind of talking about, we missed a week this past week for gaming, and I've been listening to a couple of actual plays out there of people creating characters, and I'm reaching the point where I'm struggling. I want to keep the current campaign going, I want to get the end of the story, but the desire to make a new character, it's overwhelming there. It's like, how do you
Why
guys...
Why don't you just make a new character?
I don't want to just make a new character to make a new character, I only want to make new characters to do things. Because there's something about making a new character, when you make a character... You go through all of the, well, what's the backstory? What's the current story? What's the stats, if you care about the stats? And then you have all this potential. The character hasn't done anything yet because you haven't played it yet. But so, it has the potential of being awesome.
Yeah, Wayne, so
the
this cool is part- why I have 30 starts to Oblivion and no character past level 5. No, I'm serious. I get what he's saying. I don't do it in role-playing games. In role-playing games, I typically only start eyeballing other characters if something's wrong in my current marriage. If this character and I are not getting along, or there's another idea that's really cool. I mean, I have to get pretty, disaffected before I'm going to start shopping around for other characters.
Well, that's the thing. I don't even have a character in mind.
In video games, I'm notorious for this. Ask Jeff from Gaming Asylum, because he's probably got a running count of how many characters I created for Dragon Age 1 before I finally beat the game.
Well, and also, I mean, you guys know me when it comes to MMOs, I'm an alt-aholic. I don't ever play just one character. I've usually got like 20 of them going at some point because I like character creation. When the surge hits, what do you guys do? Or well, am I just odd for having the surge?
I do have to ask you, I'll have to reassert my question here a little bit more seriously. You really like character creation. Great, I get it. Why don't you just create a character? Why does it have to be attached to a campaign? And I understand campaigns are fun and we want to play them.
So
but
you're saying create a character you're not going
to
play?
Yeah. Why specifically don't you want to do that?
It's like masturbation without reaching completion. There's no point. For me, the idea of making a character that you're not going to play with, first of all, I don't care about that character because I know I'm not going to play with it. Second, the big part of it is that end, you know, it has all this potential. There's no potential if you know there's no game there. It's like creating it in a vacuum.
Yeah, but there's still a level of satisfaction in doing that, though, I think. Your analogy actually is somewhat accurate, but yet at the same time, it still feels pretty good. So,
all right, we're not going to spend the next 15 minutes dissecting the similarities and differences between...
I'm just saying, at the core of it, his analogy is pretty correct. Yeah. But yet...
It's not as much fun doing it alone either. I like the interaction with other people.
Absolutely.
I like playing off of what other people are doing, seeing what, what character is making, what character Pat is making, tying them together.
Oh,
that's part of character creation for me.
Tying them together. Yeah.
That is part of character creation. I would have put together that group template.
Here's the problem. You can never be a chick creating a chick.
there is an enjoyment factor in there because really what it does for me when I have done that is... Now we can't get away from Wayne's damn analogy. Wayne's damn analogies. The thing is that it helps to immerse you more in that world because you do start thinking about that character and what region is he from and way out. Like you said, what is his backstory? What did he do to get where he is today? And how would he interact with the events that are going on right now? And is there a spot where he might be able to come in or something? And it, without the assistance of the GM, it pulls you into that world a little bit more. And actually, and for me in the past, it has made me enjoy my current character better get more out of that current character. And yeah, sure, you do have a little bit of unfulfillment if you can never play that character. But yet at the same time, it's still fun to think about.
I found a real simple way to keep myself from doing this, which is simply to be that in love with the character I have. The only reason right now I am not rolling around other character concepts is because of the fact that I enjoy Gnarl so much, I have no interest in toying with anything else. Now, having said that, I'm going to concede two things. First of all, Gnarl's easily in my top five characters ever played. Obviously, not every character I play is in my top five characters ever played. Secondly, being a GM at heart, while I love playing, I'm very much enjoying Chad's game. I'm a GM at heart. What is constantly nagging at my mind is not different characters. It's different campaigns and different plots. Not because there's anything wrong with Chad's, but just because that's where my eye wanders. And Wayne, Chad gave you some advice at dinner that I'm going to echo, which is probably the best thing you can do is to exercise the same sort of restraint I have to as a GM, which is don't have these conversations. Don't look at those books.
One thing kills a campaign quicker than Christmas does, and that's talking about other games. It's new shiny. Or that even extends to talking about a new character concept, even in the same campaign world. It's one thing when you have a type of group that plays a campaign, then starts talking about a different group within the campaign, and then they sort of take a sidebar. That's a whole different ball of wax there, but it's the new shiny thing. Yes. New campaign, new game system, new setting, whatever. And people start talking about, wouldn't it be cool this? Wouldn't it be cool this? Oh, we're just talking about how cool it is. We don't want to end this current campaign. Well, suddenly the campaign you're playing becomes old hat. The way I've dealt with it is to not deal with it. You don't talk about it. I stop the conversations when I have
another thing is to look at it with very, very cynical but very realistic eyes. That character, that campaign, that whatever, that right now I am so internally hyped to play, that's the one that I'm going to be trying to find a way to kill 6 months from now for the exact same reason I'm trying to kill this one.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the difference for me is...
Rupert Holmes had to look through the classified ads to find out how much he loves his wife. That normally doesn't work out that way, so...
I guess the difference
for me
is that...
Did you know there's a sequel to that song?
It's not actually a new character...
No, I did not.
...or a new concept or anything. It's just the process of creating. That's what I get hooked on.
And that's what I'm talking about. The sheer process of doing it, it's fun. It is fun to do because it's just fun to just, I was going to say massage the numbers, but it's fun to take a look at the numbers and just see how, you know, better things balance out. Or if you're in a skill-based game to, you know, take a new set of skills or whatever. It's just, it's fun to engage in that crunch every now and again, even if you may not end up doing it. Plus, it does help you learn the rules a little bit better too at times.
What I hear you saying, Wayne, is it's a percentage thing. Do you get 50% enjoyment out of creating character and then 50% enjoyment out of playing the character? Or is it more like 60-40 or 70-30? Or, I mean, where does that percentage fly? Because the only point that I'm making here is that if it's 90-10, then go home and make some characters. And write whole backstories. You're a writer, too. You can make these characters and their backgrounds or histories, all that sort of stuff, put them in a file, and then when you're writing a new story, new book, whatever, you have a go-to guide for ready-made characters.
I guess the difference is those are, again, characters made in a vacuum. Mm. The whole process of character creation to me isn't just creating one character. It's creating the group, the,
why don't you create the
game, the
group?
Everything.
Finally, you can get a group that Wayne wants.
I don't want a group that I would want.
I think you'd make a fun group.
I wonder how many people there actually are like that, because that is not something that crosses my mind at all, ever.
Yeah.
I never am thinking, oh my God, I want to create, I want to roleplay a new character. I am focused on this one, and it's nothing that ever crosses my mind.
It never crosses my mind either, simply because when I make a character, I can make enough to kind of get the character started and enough to throw some hooks out to a GM, make some entry points for the group, for him to fit in with the group, or the group to fit in with him, or vice versa, whatever. But that's it. It's not what I would consider a good character. I have to play a character at least 2 to 3 sessions before I really understand the character and get into it and start caring about the character.
I actually play in the same manner, and I think a lot of people do, more so than they would admit. I think that you can develop a character as much as you possibly can, like what you're saying. Write it all down on paper, think it all out. I mean, you've got everything down to like 5 generations back, their backstory, all this crap and all this other thing. You think, I have this character, as Wayne would say, 1,000% in my head. But
I
really don't.
I never use 1,000. I go to 200 sometimes.
Pat, as an engineer, does that deeply upset you?
More than you know.
200% agree.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I will admit that I do 200% agree to things occasionally.
Yes,
because I know how much it bothers
you. Yeah. It does.
I
read it and I'm just like, I'm yelling.
Sweat's starting to beat on his forehead.
If you see
that vein pulsing,
if you see me type it in the forums in a thread that I know you're in, there is a good chance I only put that in just for you.
Oh man, you know, I didn't even know that about you. And I have done that, but now I know for sure what I'm going to be doing at any possible opportunity.
I don't present you right, Chris.
What?
But anyway, the point that
our
I was...
fault. It's our archetypes.
Do not make me go nuclear on your asses. Okay. Now, the point that I was getting at, though, is that you can have all this stuff in your head. You can have it all figured out. You think you know this character inside and out, and then you come and you sit down and you play in the first session. All of a sudden happens that you're like, I never would have thought that. Just like what you're saying, Chad, you have to sort of kick the tires and shake out the nuts and bolts of it.
There would
because it comes with that play. You just can't do it all, you
the
know,
way
beforehand.
I see it, when I bring a character to a game, I'm bringing their backstory, their history, all of that. I don't know their personality. I never know their personality until I'm interacting with the other people at the table.
I'm glad you say that, because I think that's what has been. I think there are a lot of people that think that they do. They have, I know how this person, I know this character, and I know what his personality is going to be. And they try to do that. And then I think they quickly realize, yeah,
I'm actually on the other side.
Well, I think that what some people do, I think it's split. Personally, I think a lot of people do what Pat and I do, is what we just described. I think that other people, because I know that Dan does this, I've seen you do it before, you create the sort of calculus of the character.
Yeah.
You create this aspect of his personality, this aspect of his backstory, this, and it's a very well-rounded, when he comes to the table, he has his whole character. And when you play it, you come to one of those decision points, like with my character, it's like, does he do the good thing or the bad thing? Well, he does the bad thing, then I think about, why did he do the bad thing? And that makes the character. You come to that decision point and you say, he will do A or B. He will do this good thing because the calculus of the character is such that I have wrote him to where he would do that. I don't want to say that,
it's
that
not
you're putting him on, you're not putting him on the rails.
Well, yeah, it's not per se
like
that.
I mean, it's a little too cut and dry.
Because
but.
I have certainly had situations where my character surprised me.
Yeah.
Or when I actually started playing them, they weren't what I expected. But more often than not, yeah, they are pretty well written before the game. I guess this is just because I like writing worlds, and when I've only got one character, the only world I can write is his.
Well, I've read your Gnarl report, and you wrote the character as if you would write a game, because I've read your game notes before.
Honestly, you're basically right. That is exactly what goes on. That's, once again, it's not to say my characters don't surprise me or I don't find out I liked or disliked something that I thought was going to go the other way.
Or the chaos of the world.
Yeah, the chaos of the world changes that. Wow, I never
Gnarls
saw that
a daddy. You never wrote that.
No.
In the beginning.
Wayne's character almost threw me for a loop with some other stuff, and then he wussed out and put Gnarl right back where he was.
No, I think Wayne made the excellent decision. It was very in character.
So, but the point...
He's a bon vivant. Why would he go camping with the Knolls?
Yeah, I know. I almost respected him. Heaven, we can't have the game be any different than real life. I mean, so...
But, you know, I guess that's why I break the difference between both you guys. I love doing the whole backstory. I like to sit down and write it, too. But again, for me, the personality is what I can't feel until the game started. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot more back writing than Chad, but I don't have this personality worked out like Dan does coming in. So like usual, I'm somewhere in between.
So Wayne, at the end of it, how are you resolving this internally?
I fight myself to not think about fire integration.
Whatever you do, don't think about cats. Gotcha.
I tell Chad, we really need have games. We really need to have games. And kind of push for...
Yeah, that
we need to start playing again.
Yes, that I'll agree with.
When we're playing regularly and we don't have things breaking up the game, it's
my
a
wife
lot.
Flying out to Minnesota. Chris, you're from Minnesota, right?
Originally, yes.
Dawn flew out to Minnesota over the weekend.
Nice!
Yeah, geez, some anime convention. I don't even know what city she was in.
Oh, darn. Well, that was my next question.
Yeah, I don't even know the name of the con. She had a great time.
Can you at least picture where it's a boot?
Well, you know what? We're south enough in Minnesota that we do not say a boot or a.
She came home and I was like,
but yes, he didn't argue about pitcher.
we were talking and I'm like, so Dawn, where are you going? And she's like, I'm going to Minnesota. And I'm like, you said it wrong. And it was like, Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Say it like Minnesota. You're going to drink it. Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Minnesota. That's right.
But yeah, she said she had a lovely time there. It was great.
That's awesome.
Anime convention.
They even have anime conventions in Iowa, believe it or not.
Really?
Absolutely.
Imagine they'd be well attended, but I guess what else is there to do out there?
Well, exactly. You're either that or you're detasseling corn, depending upon who you know.
Yeah. They could do what they do on farms in southern Missouri, like Pat, you know, throw feces at electric fences, but...
Or throw girls at feces at electric fences.
Yeah.
Hey. Gotta do something.
Yeah, you know, and this may be... Yeah, and you've been playing for what? How long, Wayne? Like, what, less than 2 years?
Two or three years. I've been to three for the con, so I guess...
Yeah, but well, okay, we'll call it three. Yeah. But this could be somewhat symptomatic of your relative newness to the hobby, because I remember specifically back in my first days with Advanced D&D, I had a loose leaf just filled with... a ton of characters, about half of only which I ever played. But I just would go, and I would go ahead and just create them to have them just in case, you know, we ever needed that type of character, depending upon what we were doing.
No, but it's not newness. It's just a personality type, because I didn't do that when I first started role-playing either. I've been the same way ever since.
I never made folders worth of characters.
I'm with Wayne, though. There's a lot of fun to it. I enjoy doing it.
Oh, you're just two peas in a pod, and that's cute.
Pat, are you getting jealous?
No, I'm not.
What did you just say?
Game mastering. I sat around writing plots and NPCs. I was never player characters, but
absolutely.
Really?
It's always going to be generating ideas. You just never know when you're going to need one.
You know, I don't even write their names.
The ones you're using.
I know. I got to ask my players what this character's name is sometimes.
I think I'm with Pat. I think it's a personality thing. The three people on the podcast here that really enjoy writing and aspire to that are the three people that this is going through our heads.
Well, and that's what makes sense. I would expect that out of because when we first talked about this, my advice to you was going to be make the damn characters and then put them in a story. I mean, if you're going to create all these characters and you hate that they're just going to sit around, well, write about them because, that's what you do.
That's the engineering.
And that's what
that's a sort of engineer, I guess, in both of us, because that's what I just do. It's just like, I have a problem and I don't know what to do about it. Well, the engineers are like, well, take the problem and make it practical.
Yeah.
And then the artists are like, no, it doesn't work like that. It's my art.
Yep.
Yep.
Hear it all the time.
And they're like, 200%. It's my art. What's that a boot?
Hey, it's not our fault. We're the writer archetypes.
Yeah.
All right.
So before Pat's head explodes.
If nothing else, this episode has started out great for the sole purpose of Pat's glowing red face multiple times in the episode.
Glowing red face. I just am shaking my head in derision. I just don't know what to do.
It is funny watching Pat's skin tones. because he's like a demi ginger. He's not quite a ginger.
I am not even near a ginger. I have dishwater blonde hair. I always have.
What's left?
Actually, when I was Duncan's age, yeah. I looked just like my son, my oldest son Duncan, who has bleached white blonde hair.
He's it's very light. Child.
It's a towhead, and I was too. And my hair was that color until I was
a
about
towheaded child,
10 years old, and then it basically went to this, you know, sandy dark blonde color, which is like dishwater blonde.
My hair,
I don't have anything resembling a bit of red or anything like that in my hair at all.
Actually, I'm glad we're having the red hair discussion because I have to correct something.
Okay.
So you know, I said several episodes back that gingers are getting sort of bred out of existence because it's like less than 1% of the world's population. It's like 0.5% of the world's population is redhead. And thus, when you people breed, it's hard for a redhead to find another redhead and blah, blah, blah. And I read this article and somebody actually kind of made fun of me for that, and rightly so. And so I'm like, well, I can't possibly be wrong. I'll look this up and prove myself right. Well, I actually looked it up and it turns out that article that I had read, which is a very scientific article from years and years ago, had all this information on it. It's actually a hoax. It was a hoax put out by a tabloid that was taken seriously and picked up by major news organizations for a run of a couple of months, got out there in the public consciousness, and now people think that, well, a lot of people like myself, about how I used to, think that redheads are kind of leaving the human race.
Well, I was
and
say,
it's not true in any way.
Because I may be wrong. I haven't read about it, but I'm under the assumption or the impression that a redhead is sort of like it's a genetic mutation, or not a mutation, but it's a
defect.
It's a genetic anomaly.
Well,
like Dan and Carla could have a redheaded child. As odd as that sounds, it can happen.
Because
you don't have to be a redheaded.
No, I'm telling you straight up, she pops out a redheaded kid. There is going to be a genetic test. I'm just saying.
Well, all I'm saying though is that, you know, you don't have to. Your parents don't have to have red hair for you to be a redheaded.
It's a recessive trait. If you have two people with black hair, it is possible they can both have the recessive trait and have.
That's what I was going for. God, it's been so long since I've had biology.
In high school, I actually had some friends that
were the old Punnett square thing. I mean,
yeah.
In high school, I actually had some friends. They both had black hair. Both of their parents had red hair. I actually was in Lamaze class with them. I was very close to them.
Wait, what?
Whoa. High school?
Yeah. I was their backup coach.
Parents?
What the? Wait, student? What? You were in a Lamaze class 16. In your high school?
Yeah. Wait. Like I said, I was their backup
coach. Your high school needed a Lamaze class. Team
Brady? No. It wasn't at the high school.
Dan, I have something horrible to tell you that our high school needed a Lamaze class,
so did
but didn't
mine.
Have one.
Ours
but
needed it, but we didn't
Lamaze
have one.
The Lamaze class isn't surprising. I just need a clarification. Yeah. Were you a Lamaze, backup Lamaze coach
backup
for the
coach.
Students?
Students, yeah.
Not the parents.
These were,
because of the way you'd worded it, I thought you'd say
but
parents.
You were in high school?
That works for me.
As a teenager, my two best friends, it was a guy and his girlfriend, she got pregnant.
Yeah.
You know, they started going to a Lamaze class. This wasn't at school. This was at the hospital.
Oh. Right.
I was their backup coach. So I went through all the classes and all that. The whole point of this, though.
Well, that's let down. That was almost a Wayne's Awkward.
No, it was. Almost. Oh, it was. Because the way you said it was in high school.
It was either home ec shop or Lamaze class.
Whole point of the story, though, was that they both had black hair, but both of their parents had red hair.
Yeah.
So I used to regularly, almost every day, draw out that pundit chart and show them there is a 25% chance your kid can come out with red hair.
Yeah.
So I was in there when the baby was born. We come out. I'm there standing with the father as he's talking to his family. They're like, who does it look like? Does it look like her? Does it look like you? He's like, it looks like Wayne.
And Wayne's like, zip.
I think I'll leave now.
Yeah.
My work here is done.
For years, people seriously thought that was my kid. My mom was walking through a grocery store with, you know, her and the baby.
I like
and
how
someone
he's trying
didn't
to couch this in a pundit square. No, really, there's a chance. I swear to God, look at the square, people. It's not my kid.
My mom was actually accused of lying because she said that it wasn't my kid. And people really believed it because she came out redheaded, puffy cheeks.
The pundit square, swear to God.
And I spent a lot of time with them.
You
didn't see them without me.
Pundit,
and then they come out with a redheaded kid.
Pundit lucked out in that they named the square after his last name, because I think his first name was Reginald. It was like Reginald C. Punnett. He's lucky they went with a last name. It's not a Reginald Square.
What were we talking about?
Yeah, so what we were going to be talking about.
We were talking about I spread horrible misinformation because I was tricked in the 80s, and I am sorry.
I tell you, you know what's funny, too, is I actually really hate that one. I had all kinds of tangents on it, too, but that I'm not going to get into, about all kinds of weird genetic traits that two people can pop out where it looks like the kid ain't theirs, but it is. Yeah. But that's
my parents have black hair.
That's a wild tangent for another show.
Well, I say my parents are black. And
you're Jewish?
So, you know what's funny is I even suggested a bonus episode. Oh, no, we need a regular episode. I think we're going to be laser focused on gaming, dice, and math.
We're at the halfway point. We can continue on with that.
I guarantee they're going to love this episode 200% better than the last one.
Did you just die a little inside?
Yes,
127% better, actually.
Yeah.
Back on the topic of gaming, what we were going to talk about is homebrews. Now, let me couch this subject pretty carefully because of where I don't want it to go. We are not talking about game design. We may someday reattempt that subject. That day is not today or tomorrow.
50% of our audience just groaned and the other 50% just cheered.
That's fine. 100% of them will be let down. So we're not talking about game design. What we are talking about is instead the choice to homebrew and the approaches to doing it. Because the question that was posed at dinner by Chad.
Thank you.
You're welcome, you. Even though you stole my Tootsie Pop, I will not steal your limelight.
Sure as hell did. Even though you tried to attribute it to Wayne, I'm so goddamn jealous.
Well, that was before recording is on. Not everything I say prior to recording is true.
That's true.
I hit the red button on Audacity.
We dodged that bullet.
So, the question that Chad posed was, he said, with this many products out there, because, let's be honest, especially in the age of digital publishing, there's a lot of stuff out there.
There's something for everybody, and it's easy and fairly cheap to get.
Yeah, it may be somewhat hard to find because of the amount of flotsam and jetsam that's out there, but nonetheless, it is out there. So the question was posed, and this led into other questions that we'll try to hit in turn, but this seems like a good one to start in. Why do it? Why take the time to homebrew? And I've got a couple answers to that.
Because nobody can do it better than I can.
You know what? As arrogant as that sounds, I think if you phrase it in terms of according to my own tastes,
exactly,
nobody can do exactly what I had in mind. You are 100%
not only
correct. 200% correct.
200. Well, I say I'm 101% correct.
101.5 All right.
0.5. There we
go. I'm just amazed this conversation happens because I had to fight to get a system that wasn't a homebrew in. So every campaign I've played in, except for this one, which let's face it, we homebrewed most of this one at this point.
Well, and Jeff's kind of let down. He's like, man, I couldn't wait to join you guys. I mean, Fear the Boot, we're going to play some weird indie game or a homebrew or whatever. All kinds of experimental stuff. And he shows up, we're playing D&D 3.5.
But are we really playing D&D 3.5?
No, but it's still all right. But anyway, so go on.
So anyway, getting back to the point, nobody knows what my tastes are in a role-playing game, or at least nobody out there is really writing towards that. They might write something, and I might like it, but nobody knows specifically what exactly I want out of a role-playing game. And hell, I'm not even sure what I want out of a role-playing game. And that changes from game to game and system and setting that I play in. Furthermore, nobody knows what my group's predilections are because my group, their tastes are different than mine. You know, I can't do a Jenga tower in some indie game and make a campaign out of it because these guys want something more than that. They want a bit more crunch. They want a bit more tactical. And that's cool. That's absolutely cool. And I think it's my job as a game master to deliver that.
Right.
And so we're talking about, you know, indie games and these homebrews that we make. And Jeff was really looking forward to what we're playing 3.5. Well, we're joking. We're not really playing 3.5. What I've done is I've just thrown out all the stuff I don't like about 3.5, like 90% of the rules. And I kind of just go with what works for me. It's like, because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to deliver enough crunch and enough tactics to these guys to make them happy. I'm trying to go as rule light for me, because from my perspective, again, people are going to be like, no, you're so wrong. From my perspective, the rules distract from the role playing. So I'm trying to do this balance so that everybody has fun.
All right.
Everybody has fun. It's not just me delivering something. It's not just you taking something. And a game designer doesn't know that about me and my group. And so he can't make a game. He can make a game that's good, that's very good, very tight, very cool, very cutting edge and different. He can make a setting that's very cutting edge and different. That's another thing, is setting. We're playing a fantasy game. I don't want elves in my fantasy game. I don't want dwarves. I don't want high magic. But again, these guys, especially Pat, because you're playing a wizard, you want to be able to shoot fireballs out of your arcs every now and again. You want to be able to do some crazy stuff. Everybody else, and Dan wants to play a gnoll, and I want to play a fantasy game that doesn't have any fantasy races in it. But that's not a game ender for me, and Dan knows that.
Right.
And so we can compromise, and we made this whole setting. It's not a compromise in that everybody loses. Nobody gets what they want. It's everybody gets what they want in a way that works. And so we've created this sort of homebrew on the shambling skeleton of D&D 3.5.
We'll talk in a minute about the line between homebrewing and simply modifying right. an established game. Not so much just to wank over exactly where that line is, but just to talk about why you would want to do one versus the right. other. But there are really two things, I think, that draw me back to homebrews again and again and again. And thing one is the thing that you just said there, which is that nobody out there, despite the number of games out there, and there are some damn good games out there
very
that I
games.
Very much enjoy, and I own those games. I buy those games. I will continue buying those games and playing those games. I have nothing against other people's stuff. But look, when you become a game designer, it's not like you go off to RPG college and get a doctorate in RPGs or whatever. No, you're somebody who loved the games enough to make your own. And don't get me wrong, some people got it, some people don't. And on top of that, I also recognize that whether you have it or don't, there are things you can learn through experience and collaboration.
Well, and a company also has the ability to do massive play tests,
yes,
hire a professional editor. There are some things that they bring to the table.
But at the end of the
not
day...
Not gameplay things necessarily, right. but some
There's
things.
There's no fundamental skill. I mean, it's not like a cardiologist. There's no fundamental skill set they have that you are just incapable of getting. And so when I sit down at a table and say, look, I've got this idea in my head. I want a game that fits exactly what I want, exactly what my group wants. Why not bust out? Skies of Glass came originally from a commentary. We were sitting around an Apple IIc or IIe or something like that some years ago, like in the mid-90s, replaying Wasteland.
Oh,
and somebody said,
great game.
We ought to make a Wasteland RPG.
Mm-hmm.
Skies of Glass is almost no reflection of Wasteland, but that's how it started.
Yeah, evolved in so much over the years. Another complaint that we had that ties off that with our Skies of Glass game, we wanted to play a Wasteland RPG. Total fan wank RPG. I mean, more so, we wanted to play a post-nuke, post-apocalypse game. The only post-apocalypse game out there that we knew of was Twilight 2000, which totally did not fit in any way what we wanted to achieve.
Not even close.
Yeah, I mean, is it a good game, bad game? I don't know. I never played it. I flipped through it enough to say this is not where we're going with this. And there wasn't really, to our knowledge, because this was kind of before Google and stuff like that, where we can search for this stuff, to our knowledge, there wasn't anything else. We had to make it.
I wonder, is this sort of just a logical progression for the GM types? And what I mean by that is, I've actually known a couple other people that have done homebrew type settings. They did it with just plain fantasy. It wasn't like what you guys have got some great examples here of you want to do something and there's just really not a good game existing out there that covers this. I think that's a different issue than what I'm getting at. I have seen ones where they basically took fantasy setting and said, okay, I want to play these fantasy characters instead of playing it in D&D. I want to make my own setting, my own homebrew. And my question is this kind of logical for you GM types? You've got this creative bug, and since you're yes. already making up stuff, you just decide that the logical next step is to make your own world complete.
Yeah. Do you know who agrees with you 100%, Pat?
Who's that?
Gary Gygax.
Okay.
In his god-awful book, Master Game Master, he lines out how to run a game and all that sort of stuff, gives advice, and basically D&D dungeon crawling type stuff. But what he is fundamentally saying, he says it's a process. This is a natural process for every role player. Somebody gets you into gaming, then you want to improve your game, and so you become a game master, and you start your own game master. The natural progression from Game Master is to write your own game. And I'm not talking an adventure. I'm talking not talking a module. I'm talking game system. And then the next step to him is start a gaming convention to promote your own game.
Which we would totally say is crap, except for the fact that
you've walked that entire path.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about that is how Pat couched that. He's talking about creating a homebrew setting. For me, I don't consider it a homebrew unless it's a new system. I automatically assume that when I take a book, I'm going to throw away everything in the setting and just use the system.
Well, Pat,
I never even imagined using the setting.
There is certainly a distinction between homebrewing the whole game homebrewing the system and homebrewing the setting. But Pat, what you got at right there is the second point I was going to raise on why I'm a big fan of homebrewing, which is it's an insatiable desire to create. Once I've created a character, I want to create a plot. Once I've created a plot, eventually things in the game will dissatisfy me, or I'll have an idea of my own that just occurs to me while I'm driving to work. And that eventually builds up into its own game. And that is absolutely the reason why. There could be games that are exactly what I want, 100% already published, and I would still probably keep on homebrewing, just because it is this insatiable desire to keep creating. I mean, there's probably no artist out there who's painting something that's never been painted before. But
yeah, you know, for me, it's been a lot like that, in the sense that you play a game, and then you kind of realize at some point, you're like, I can do this also. This isn't really that hard. And so you start tinkering with your own rules and seeing what it is you want to try and recreate, whether or not you want to actually tune something in to your own particular kind of game that you want, like you guys did with Skies of Glass, but also just you look at it and you think, I can do that. This is not that difficult. And so you make that effort to go ahead and do it, and whether or not it really works, you know, is dependent upon how well it's received, I guess.
So do you guys always have the grass is always greener outlook on games?
Yes. No, I have ideas are always better.
Pat, I'm going to totally admit it. Yes. And a lot of times I end up hopping the fence and pretty quickly realizing the grass is just as brown here. And then I hop the next fence and next fence. There was a short story.
And somewhere there you want to make a new character, right?
Yeah. Honestly, Wayne, it's the same disease, different symptoms, same disease.
It's going to be interesting 2 years from now if we come back to this conversation to see if I'm even further down this path towards you guys. Because right now the idea of going through and doing the math, creating a system, there's so many systems out there. I don't want to do that part. Yeah. I just want to create the settings in the world.
There was a short story I read several years ago. I have no idea what the name of the short story was, but there was a particular phrase in it that has stuck with me for a long time. The short story is about a man and a woman who were apparently romantically involved at one point, meeting at like a train station or something, and they're having coffee and they're talking to each other, but the whole time they're kind of talking past each other. And the story is really about why the romance didn't work, even though I don't think they ever actually directly bring that subject up. It's just implied in the background. But there's a line in that story where it talks about like something to the effect of he or she, one of the characters, felt this great beast in their heart stretching its paws outward and yawning as it looked towards the next horizon or something like that. And that was the point of the character, was that this character was never going to be satisfied. They were always looking for what was over the horizon. Well, you never reach the horizon. And you are absolutely right. That level of discomfort, that level of the grass must be greener, is what keeps pushing me. And the insanity of it is the grass isn't greener. But the beauty of it is it keeps me striving. It keeps me working. It keeps me doing new things.
For some reason, when you talked about never reaching the horizon, all I could think of was the old Battle Zone stand-up arcade game, which was it was all vector graphics.
Oh, and Battle Zone. There was a sit-down version with a periscope.
Well, yeah. No. They had stand-up ones, too, as well.
Yes, they did.
They all had that. But when I used to play that game, all I wanted to do was reach those damn mountains, and it never reached the mountains. And I would sit there and I'd be driving to my tank, and it's like, stop throwing these stupid things in my way to try and kill me. I just want to reach the mountains, damn it. And of course, you never could.
Wow.
Just like with playing
life.
Pitfall. It's like you wanted to get around to the other side.
Except, yeah, there's no end to it. Pitfall's an infinite game.
Mm. Yeah.
Where does that road in Spy Hunter go?
Exactly.
Spy Hunter actually does have an end, I thought. Oh, does it reset?
It loops.
I thought you could actually reach the end of it. Okay.
That was a sweet-ass game, by the way. Spy Hunter was one of the funnest arcade games.
I never played any of these games. I remember I finally got Spy Hunter on my Nintendo. I was so happy because I loved that game. Yeah. I loved playing it at the arcade. I'm like, oh my God, I want that so bad.
I played hours of it on my Nintendo.
Yeah, me too.
I played it on the PC, and there's a game glitch. You know that limo that would drive up and a guy would lean out and shoot at you? Mm-hmm. There was a game glitch where just the arm would come down the highway shooting at you.
That is awesome.
That was awesome. All right, so Wayne, you brought something up, which I want to talk about, which is the distinction between homebrewing the whole game versus only doing the setting, only doing the system.
Yeah, I was shocked to discover that if you change the world in the book, that some people consider that a homebrew. Because for me, it's all about the system. I just thought everyone just threw away the setting in the book. I didn't realize people actually used it.
You know, honestly, in fact, I would say more often than not, while I tend to adjust settings to try and make them a little more to my taste, or in some cases what I feel is a little more internally consistent, more often than not, I tend to keep the setting. And it's typically the system I will do a lot more work on than the setting. But, you know, I've seen it several ways. I mean, look, that was the point of the whole OGL D20 thing, was to create this homogenous system that everyone would use for everything and encourage people to go out and make their own settings for it. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think there are some people out there where, look, they want a singular set of systems, or they don't want to have to learn a new system, or they don't want to write a new system because they're not that big into math. And I get that.
That's one of the reasons Savage Worlds is so popular.
Yes.
It fits well with what most people want to do.
But I think what bugs me about
it fits with what most people want to do. I think it's bland.
Well, my complaint is simpler than that, which is system implies setting.
Yeah.
How likely a critical success is says something about your setting.
Yeah.
As a result, when you play all these different settings with one system, they start to feel too similar. We did that ourselves with, and I'm not bashing Savage Worlds. Savage Worlds is a great system. If you don't have the $10 Explorers book, go get it.
Yeah.
But we did that to ourselves where we played like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, I don't know, too damn many campaigns in a row. Everything that were came all so Savage Worlds.
Everything was so samey. You make a character. Even if you don't min-max and twink out the character, you want to make a good character. You want to make it generally effective. I mean, I'm not a min-max or rules guy, but, you know, there's stuff you take, and then there's, you know, this power is pretty worthless. And I noticed that after a while, all my characters were becoming very samey. The characters were totally different, and we could be playing in a magic world, or we can be playing in a sci-fi world with no magic. I could just transfer the character sheets. All the character sheets were the same. And that's what I didn't like about Savage.
It reminds me of some of the video games I've played in the past where you come up with a character that has, it could have an ice blast, it could have a fire blast, it could have an energy blast, but the only difference in the blast is the color.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, you're doing the same thing, you're doing the same amount of damage, but the color of it's different.
That is Savage Worlds. Well, that's why Savage Worlds works in con games. But
that point was really driven home to me by Savage Worlds. That was sort of in the back of my mind beforehand, because, I mean, when you do really think about it, especially with magic, all damaging spells do the same thing. They cause damage. It's just, how do you couch it? Is it a fireball? Is it an ice blast? Is it acid? You know, so
even in D&D, that's the same thing.
Exactly. But, you know, at least what I like about D&D, though, and even other, like the OpenGL systems, at least there, every different setting sort of has its own book where it encapsulates everything that's in this world, and it calls the spells this, that, and the other. On the flip side of that is that with Savage Worlds, you've got the one booklet, and then you're making everything up yourself. I think it just drives it home a lot more, is that it's all this blast spell or this whatever, and it's, yeah, that sameness.
You remember everything I said 10 minutes ago about not wanting to go through, do the math, and make a system? Throw that all out the window. As we just had this conversation, the entire time Pat and Chad are talking, in my mind I'm like, well, if I was doing fire, I would want to do some sort of burn damage afterwards. Yep. For ice, I would want to do some sort of slow.
I told you, Wayne, you've got the same disease. You're just at a different stage. I'm telling you straight up, because that's exactly what it is. It's this insatiable desire to tinker with everything, to keep creating, to keep improving. And of course, improving in this case being subjective, it's improving to you. But nonetheless, that's where it keeps going until it ends in, you've just created your whole game. You've thrown out the setting, you've thrown out the system, you've thrown out everything, and you're making your own game. That's why I will always keep on homebrewing. Let me phrase a question. And as I said earlier, I don't want this to turn into a wank of defining the phrases. Let's just accept from what we all have a common definition, even if we don't. What makes you choose to homebrew versus heavily modify a system? Let's say you find a game that's pretty close to what you want. What would make you decide, okay, I'm just going to tinker with this system, but basically keep the system and setting, versus I'm going to throw this out the window and start from scratch? Versus possibly a third option of, I'm going to create the Franken game where I've got the magic system from this game and the character creation system from that game and the die mechanic from some third game. And
now I have three answers to your
question. Well, give me tons of answers.
So the first thing I have is that I would make my own system from scratch if I'm doing basically kind of what I want and I don't have to kind of worry about it, what anybody else is thinking. Or maybe I have a group that just doesn't care what the system is as long as there is a system. I would modify a game, though, which is exactly what I'm doing now, even though with our current campaign, even though I've sold it to you guys that we're playing straight up 3.5, it's taken you all of 2 minutes to figure out that wasn't how it was going to go down after the first game.
Well, and even the game you released, Lucid, is a modification of Dread.
Heavy modification, yeah. I would modify a game if the group wants a specific thing. They want a specific feel, they want a specific something, and there's a game out there that gets close, I can take that game and then I can kind of adjust it to where it goes beyond getting close and it hits. It hits real, real close to what the group wants.
I think a good example for me would be Shadowrun with the decking rules.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that decking rules take one guy completely out of the game. You know, I'm pretty satisfied with Shadowrun apart from that.
Right.
I realize it's a controversial opinion to have on this show, but nonetheless.
I don't care about the Shadowrun rules. I don't like the setting.
Well, I do like the setting.
I don't know anything about
that. That's why you're wrong.
Okay, well, point being, though, that's an example of a game where I'm satisfied with everything in general, but there is...
Although I do agree with you on the decking thing.
Yeah.
In concept.
It's kind of a group-shattering concept where half the party's got their thumb up their ass for an hour, and so I just yanked that out. And yeah. Years ago, and I don't still have these, I wish I still did, but years ago I wrote some sort of abbreviated rules where mm-hmm. you would still have all the attributes and programs of the deck, but they were just simpler, quicker rolls and dice right. pools as opposed to actually going from node to node to node in this endless grind fest against the ice.
The third option you brought up is the Franken game. It's not taking one game and modifying it. It is the idea of you like the decking system from Shadowrun. You like the combat system from World of Darkness, but you like the skill system. I'm looking at Dan's books on his shelf here of what he has to get ideas here. You like the skill system from the Webster's New Thesaurus and Dictionary. You guys get what I'm saying. You like the different aspects of all these different games. What I would do personally in that situation is if we're building a collaborative game, it's what I wish we would have done with our current campaign. Because, again, to bore everyone with the story, everybody made a character, and the character was rooted in some greater than them aspect of the world. There was the leadership of the kingdom that Pat is part of. There was the Knoll and the War Society that Dan's character Gnarl was a part of. And, you know, it goes on and on. What I would have loved is to extend that collaboration into the rules and either have somebody say, I have this idea. It's not from anything. Can we use this for skills? Okay, we use that for skills. And then Dan kept going on and on about how he wanted to play Shadowrun because you love the ritual magic aspect of it. I would have loved for...
We should have, because your magic system in this game, it's spirit...
Doesn't work with D&D.
It's spirit-based. It's astrally based. It's meant to be organic in nature. It's meant to be ritual based. That's the Shadowrun magic system.
Yeah. I wish we would have been able to, you know, again, collaborate with that. And Dan brings that to the table. He's like, I want this magic system in the game because it works well. And then we go around like that. And then we talk about it and we make it work.
I kind of have to rail against that third option, the Franken game, because I think... Because
you hate goodness.
No, I love goodness, and I think that is the hardest one to do
you
well.
You love double
I think
plus
that,
goodness.
I think that I that agree. Is going to be one that's going to be well. A cluster. And the reason is this. I mean, first of all, you've got balance issues. If you're just taking an aspect...
We have balance
from
issues
four
in
or five,
our
I know.
Game.
Oh, I know you do. Hear me out. Mm-hmm. If you take aspects from three or four different established systems and try to mash them together, you've got a horrible balance issue. You've got things that are not written to work together. If you're going to do it, you're going to have to take time and develop it, write it all down and get it worked out and then use it. I don't want to play in a game where you just decide to do this and like, okay, we're using five different systems at one game. All of a sudden, I as a player, I have to have five rule books in front of me to refer to all this when I'm playing it. Oh, I don't, but I should have it because, especially in your game, nothing's written down. It's right here and there.
Why wouldn't we?
And I'm not
going
to play. I don't want to play in a game where, okay, I have five different rules systems that I have part of, and I need to know what I need to do here. There,
kind of getting it. Here.
Well, no, I don't think you're getting it.
Well,
because you know you're talking about taking aspects from here, taking this from Shadowrun. I've never played Shadowrun before, so how the hell am I going to know what this is? I've got to have the source material in front of me.
Well, I think,
and all these other
I think
ones
the bigger
too.
Problem here.
We would write it down.
I think the bigger problem.
We have computers. We have the technology.
Okay, that's fine.
You guys bring your laptops to every game.
I think it's better to.
I think the bigger problem to have
make it up on your own than it is.
And
to
you already have five rule books in front of you. You have the entire OGL in front of you. It's
actually, I don't have it that much. I only have it when I have
I
to
mean,
have
when
it.
You have to cast a spell, you go through 20 pages of paper to
I know
cast
I do.
A spell.
I hate it. I hate that. And I don't do it. I've gotten away from
well,
it
I think
as
there's
well.
There's a much more fundamental problem than a number of rule books that you hit on at the very start of your commentary, which is it's the Johnny Cash one piece at a time or one part at a time, whatever the song, which is, as far as not heard it, it's a song about how he wants a brand new car. He works at a GM factory, but he can't steal a car. So instead, over the course of like 20 or 30 years of employment, he literally steals the car one piece at a time and then goes to reassemble it. But he's got parts from 30 different model years of cars. Mm-hmm. And so it's just this disaster. And it's a comedy song. But you can get the same thing. Because look, the bits and pieces of each game were hopefully fine-tuned to work with each other. When you start yanking pages wholesale from books, these are no longer meant to work together. But I think what I would recommend in terms of the Franken game.
You get that with a normal game.
Well, but
you ever played Rifts?
Well, but
you ever played the first edition of Shadowrun?
Well, like,
well, look at it from this perspective.
You're
though,
picking
Chad.
Some awful examples here.
How would
everyone's telling me my idea is an awful example. Well, why not?
How would a D&D warrior, or whatever class the equivalent of a warrior is, you know, how would a warrior defend against a Shadowrun magic? Shadowrun magic is whatever you roll for Shadowrun for magic.
See, that's just it. We have this conversation.
See, I'm actually agreeing with you. Mm-hmm. I'm agreeing with Pat in that I think there is a problematic way of doing it.
Yeah.
But what I would say is you don't take rules as is. You take concepts. And then you say, okay, how can we reapply the architecture of magic and Shadowrun, but forget the dice, just the concepts, and reapply that, let's say, within D20. And you can probably figure out some way of doing it.
Because these guys are, they're arguing the other end of it. What they're saying is, we do this, boom, done. We do it, and now it's not working in these ways, and you're giving all these examples of how it's not working. When it's just like, whoa. Let's rewind this back to, instead of, boom, we just do it, how do we do it?
What are we doing? That's the point.
Let's talk about it. It's more difficult
than just starting from scratch. Picking things piecemeal and then making them work sounds more complicated to me than just starting from scratch.
Yes.
Trust me, it is. I'm an engineer.
Yes.
It's easier to start from scratch.
It could work well. I think it would take more effort than starting over.
I understand what you're getting at, Chad.
I'm really not.
But I think the way it was presented is that I like the Shadowrun magic system. I like whatever else it is you said, and you just like mash them together, and then that's
well, what that may have been our bad for not sufficiently explaining what we meant. But I agree with you, Pat. If you end up with a game where the source book looks like somebody's scrapbooking project, you're on your way to a goddamn nightmare.
Yeah,
I mean, if you simply say, you know, look, I like concepts, or maybe like particular ideas. For example, here's one of my big bitches with D&D. I don't like the fact there's no rerolls in it. I really wish D&D had a Benny system like Savage World, or had an edge system like BattleTech or MechWarrior more specifically. And so there's an example where I could say, look, I'm going to take a concept. Now, let's say we did this on the bigger scale, like we've been talking about. I like the concept of spirit-based ritual magic. Yeah. Well, that's not part of the Vancian spell system in D&D. But is there a way, I'm not saying grab Shadowrun system wholesale, where I have 3d6 for my attributes and then a dice pool for magic, because obviously that's going to get confusing at best. But instead say, look, is there a way that we could simply rebuild this into the D20 architecture while maintaining both the basic rolling architecture D20, but the feel and the concepts from Shadowrun?
So I don't think that there's necessarily a option 2 and 3. I think that you should just call options 2 and 3 modifying a system. It's, to me, whenever you say you're going to Franken game
systems,
system, you're going to take, you know, because just to me, the image that it's brought forth with a Franken game is literally a monstrosity where you've taken pages from book and you've sewn them together with horrible macabre twine.
Well, I mean,
and
one of the
hit it with lightning.
Bad.
One of the things that was thrown out was that, well, we wouldn't want to do this because it's too much effort. Coming up with a character is a lot of effort. Coming up with a world, not as much as
a homebrew setting.
Campaign world is. I don't think so.
No,
campaign world is too much effort.
I disagree. If you are going to go to the effort to really go through and make a solid homebrewed system.
Writing a campaign
I'm talking about a system where you're going to. An adventure is a different thing. Coming up with a story idea to put in a rule system that is already existing is different. If you are going to come up with your own homebrewed system that is going to be, you know, it's going to be tried and true and tested, and it's not going to have things that can be punched and, you know, that can be manipulated, and it's got holes and loopholes in it. It takes a lot of effort. I know I've helped a couple of people do it, and you guys have done it too. You can't sit down on a weekend and come up with a homebrew system and crank it out and expect it to be perfect.
If you want to be able to take this homebrew, this rule system that you've made, and bind it and take it to a publisher and publish it and sell 100,000 copies of it, you're not going to be able to do that. We are making a system for our friends to play. At home, we are brewing a homebrew system, and it doesn't have to...
Let me ask you a perspective question that might be part of where you guys are diverging. And I
can tell you, I'm still struggling with the concept we're talking about of pulling things out of other systems and putting them together. Because when it's described, I think system, but you're talking concepts, which to me is just part of the setting, which is all going to be homebrew to me anyway.
Every system is a collection of concepts. Like, I'm talking the rule system. Every rule system is a collection of individual concepts. And I'm not saying that the concepts in a rule system are of a modular design. They're usually not. That's why you take those concepts out of a rule system. You break them down into their more simple components conceptually, and then you modify them so that you get what you want out of them to work with what you're trying to do.
And for me, that may be Frankensteining the setting. That's not Frankensteining the system to me. Well, and that's where I'm struggling to understand.
I think, all right, well, let me back up and try and explain this maybe in slightly better terms, because I'm going to say right now that I think in probably setting up this portion of the topic, this particular segment of the topic, I don't think I did a very good job of quite trying to describe what we're going for. I think one thing we would universally agree upon is that scrapbooking your game.
Right.
That just wholesale yanking a chapter out of this book, a chapter out of that book, a chapter out of the other book is nightmarish at best.
Shadowrun says use a D6, but we've used the D&D combat rules, which only use D20s. That does not work. This is a failure of concept. No one is saying that.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to agree with Pat, and I think what there may be is a conceptual difference here that has to do with the type of games people like. In the case of someone like Pat or I, we want the game to have some crunch and substance.
Certainly.
Okay, Chad, in the case of the games that you run, and once again, neither's wrong, these are just tastes. In the case of the games that you like to write and run, these are games that tend to be very rules light and also tend to rely a lot on social pacts between the players and the GM. That there's all kinds of stuff that's not even defined. We're just going to say this is reasonable or this is BS based on a subjective call at the time, and we're going to roll with that to build this very flexible, free-flowing story. Is that a fair characterization? Even if it's not quite right, is that right ballpark?
In a way, but I think that you can still make a collaborative system with a lot of crunch to it.
Oh, I agree. I agree. But what I would say, where I agree with Pat, is that the more crunch you introduce, the more details you have to think about. And this becomes compounding because every rule impacts every prior rule. And so if you want to turn out a system with a ton of crunch, then I agree with Pat that it will take a long time to do. Now, the sorts of systems like, I don't know, I don't want to start naming games because somebody's going to take me to the mat for whatever game I name. But the point is, you take one of these rules light, you know, what you yourself call these hippie sorts of games, I think you could come up with it in a weekend. Heck, Bob Ahrens, I don't want to explain it, but he came up with a system, his D Skittle system, and I'll let him explain that on the forums if he wants to. I don't want to
explain
his idea
away. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it sounded wonderful to me too, but that's the sort of system. It was real rules light. It was real, excuse the pun, flavor based. And so that's a
very colorful.
You could do that in a car ride. He literally did it in a car ride. But I mean, I don't think you could turn out something like Shadowrun or D&D or, God forbid, Champions in the course of a car ride. You have to sit down and think and play test and balance and run equations. I mean, as a huge Battletech nerd, I have done all the reverse math they did to arrive at the game. I actually did all the calculations of how they came up with engine weights and things like that, you know, making it so that the ton-by-ton creation of mechs creates balanced mechs, seeing to it that a weapon's properties, its heat versus ammo requirements versus range versus weight, you know.
Well, now you're talking about a tabletop warfare game.
Well, but fair enough. But some tabletop games have that same amount of crunch to them. That are full role-playing games, you know, have that amount of crunch to them. Now, granted, that's not the vogue thing right now. Right now, Spirit of the Century is the vogue sort of thing. Games that have more feel than finger counting.
I'm just saying that I think that if you get a group of like-minded people, you can make characters that work together.
Yes.
And I think that if you get a group of like-minded people, you can make a setting that works together. And I think that if you get a group of like-minded people together, you can make a system that works together.
And I don't think Pat was disagreeing with that. I think all he was commenting on, if once again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, was that that's a larger undertaking than, say, especially if it's a high crunch system, that's a larger undertaking than bashing out a plot.
But what's wrong with a large undertaking?
Oh, nothing. I don't think Pat was, I'm once again, Pat, don't let me put words in your mouth. I mean, am I getting this right?
That was my point. We had gone down a path where you were sort of saying that this is just something that can be done very quickly and easily.
I don't think I said that. I think Wayne came to me and he's like, this will take a lot of effort. And I said, I'm not afraid of effort.
My comment was that it would take more effort to Frankenstein a game, as we were discussing, as right. I understood it at that yes, time, right. than homebrewing.
Yes. And yes, Wayne, I believe you
at
are.
At that point, throw it all out, yes. start over from scratch, because for less effort, you can get more of what you want.
Yes, than I think you are correct. And I would go back to the Johnny Cash song. He would have had a much easier time stealing a car than he would have trying to reassemble what it was he had stolen.
And he would have been happier years. With the end product.
Yes.
Well, and I just don't think that there's anything wrong with the idea of people making up their own rule system.
Yeah, me neither.
And
yeah.
I don't think that there's anything wrong, because it's a homebrew, taking aspects that they like out of pre-existing games and using those aspects in their homebrew system.
Yes.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think that it's totally workable. Isn't that
really
kind
of the definition of a homebrew, though, to begin with? I mean, there's really, if you go with that definition, then there really is no such thing as a Franken game at that point, because it's a homebrew. If you're grabbing concepts and using them and putting your own rule structure around them, then it's a homebrew.
That was the point I was getting at earlier, too, Chris, was that I don't think there is a Franken game. It's modifying, or it's taking that. It is just a homebrew.
Well, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Well, and I suppose there's two ways to approach it. You can take the Ecclesiastes saying of there's nothing new under the sun. But I guess the difference I was saying is with a Franken game, quote unquote, you are intentionally wholesale taking what may be large structures from other games, not just little ideas, but big structures, as opposed to a homebrew where, okay, sure, it's going to have some parallel to something somewhere, if for no other reason the fact that it uses dice or a Jenga mm-hmm. tower or whatever.
Yeah.
But your intention is to keep it as original as possible, and ideally, no one can look at whole chapters of your game and say, wow, this is completely taken from Shadowrun, or this is completely taken from D&D, or whatever the case.
And I think that even if they can, it's not a big deal if they do.
Yeah.
Because you're not trying to publish it. You're not trying to make this product that you deliver to a publisher to sell. That's the great thing about homebrew, too. You can rip things off. You can rip off plot concepts. You can rip off characters. You can rip off rules and ideas and all that sort of stuff, because it's just for you and your group.
Well, it depends on what you intend to do with it, because like in my case, even though truth be told, 99% of the ideas I have are never going anywhere.
Skies of Glass is a homebrew.
Yes.
We would love to publish it one day.
And therefore I have to be careful not to take ideas from other games.
Exactly.
You know, I guess the other big difference for me is, like you said, I approach this with the concept of when I get a book, I would just throw away the setting and I would start with the rule set. So when I look at putting together if I wanted to create a game, I would want to create the feel of the rule system, the feel of the game. I wouldn't even associate a setting with that. And I know, Chad, when you make games, it's very different. Your game is very much associated with the story that you're putting into it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when you create Lucid, the concept of the game and what people are going to be doing in it is very tied into the rules of it. Same thing with your Silent Memories. You're tying those in.
Silent Memories, it really blurs the line between a game system and a module or pre-written adventure. It's more or less is a module and a pre-written adventure and a game system and a campaign setting all in one.
And that's how a lot of the indie games I've been exposed to work. Those things are so
tied
together.
That's why the whole thing can be written in 3,000 words.
Well. And that's why I don't approach it like that. So for me, I see them as two separate things that can be mixed and matched, although I know the feel is different.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're hitting up against time, but I think this is a good idea to leave this on, is the fact that certainly also the amount of work you're going to do in a homebrew is going to be heavily dependent upon how many ways it's meant to be played.
Right.
That if you are meant to only play one concept, like in Lucid, you know, you play something roughly like Inception, then it only needs so much. If you want something like D&D or like Star Wars, where you can do 1,000 different things from 1,000 different perspectives in 1,000 different places, then obviously it takes a whole lot more writing to do. So, Chris, I guess to close this out, we'll give you the final word here on this subject. What's your take on this?
My take on it, honestly, comes down to simply, I would choose homebrew over modification of a rule system simply out of a paperwork necessity. It's much easier to have a document where you've got all of your rules self-contained as opposed to a document that contradicts stuff that's in a rule book that people may reference as time goes on. If you can just hand them the sheets that have the rules on them, you've saved them time, you saved yourself time, and honestly, it's probably easier to cut from whole cloth and do it on your own than it is sit there and tinker, and then realize, oh, this didn't work, now I've got to go back and I got to change that. Granted, you'd have to do that with your own homebrew thing, but the changes are easier to facilitate at that point going forward. And it's still one self-contained document.
Right.
Plus, it's more fun.
You know, and I suppose if nothing else, homebrewing is something everyone ought to do at some point for the same reason everyone ought to try GMing at some point.
Yeah.
Just to understand what goes into it.
Yeah. So they can appreciate the work and effort that the game publishers put into their final product and about how polished it is. And again, just the amount of effort and quality that, that game publishers of all stripes are putting out nowadays.
Cool. Well, don't forget that coupon for Arc Dream. If you want anything on their store, I'll link to their store in the show notes. And I'll also put the coupon code there, which is just, once again, Fear the Boot with no spaces. And I want to thank you guys for tuning in, and I hope you have a great week. And we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.